looking at the names, it looks like it's different people from last week. Is that correct? Is there anybody here who was also here last week? The names look different. So I'm tempted, under the circumstances, rather than continuing the discussion from last week, doing something that's a little more self-contained, in which case the sources to send out when they arrive would be just the Tiferet Yisrael from the Maharal, and we will worry about the other things. We'll worry about the Sefer HaKuzari when we get up to it. Basically, to kind of fill in the background, we had spent last week, the general topic is Ta'amei HaMitzvot, is the reasons for the mitzvot, and we had spent last week trying to break down the question a little bit into its subparts, distinguishing, first of all, between the larger question of what's the point of mitzvot as a whole, which is not necessarily the same question as what's the point of a particular mitzvah. In other words, I might ask what the point of wearing, I'll take an easy one, I might ask what the point of wearing tzitzit is. So there, the psukim are pretty clear about what the point of wearing tzitzit are. Tzitzit remind you of the other mitzvot, remind you that you should not go astray following your eyes and your heart toward various undesirable things. And that explains the particular mitzvah of tzitzit. It does not explain the goal, the larger function of Torah and mitzvot as a whole. And Rambam was very conscious, we saw in the Moreh Nevuchim last week, Rambam was very conscious of the distinction between those two questions. Actually, before I continue, I just want to encourage those of you who do not have mics, and even those of you who do, to please interject, whether on the chat or over the mic with questions, comments. Because I don't know you and don't see you, it's a little hard to kind of feel the crowd, so it would be helpful, very helpful, to get feedback, comments, you know, especially in the chat or orally, whatever makes you comfortable. And Rambam had kind of largely, Rambam's large point was that in terms of the larger goal of mitzvot as a whole, what the entire enterprise is trying to accomplish, he distinguished between what we had spoken last week of tikkun haguf and tikkun hanefesh, fixing the body and fixing the soul. And fixing the body does not mean only, for Rambam, physical health of the individual. Rambam takes those terms and makes and translates them in social and political terms. The question is not only whether my individual body will be healthy or my individual soul will be healthy. The question is whether the body politic, the community, will be healthy. And Rambam immediately moves the discussion of the larger goal of Torah and Mitzvot as a whole into a social political direction. Mitzvot are meant to be kept within the community. The goal of the mitzvot is, first of all, to make sure that the community is healthy, satisfied, that people, that it is safe, that individuals feel safe within the community, and that the community provides a healthy, safe environment for the individual to develop. Development of the soul is also a social category. It's not only a question of wide eye, and Rambam, given his theory that human perfection revolves around belief, revolves around knowledge. He says, tikkun ha-nefesh, repairing the soul, means that the community as a whole should understand the truths of God to the extent that it is possible for them to do so. Now, Rambam, once he has set up this kind of framework, he adds one other critical point, and that is that of the two goals, tikkun ha-nefesh, repairing the soul, people's spiritual, religious knowledge, is the higher value, but it is dependent on tikkun haguf. It is not possible for the individual or the collective to achieve personal, spiritual, religious success outside of the context of a community that is well-structured and that is organized and that is providing support for both that individual who's striving for perfection as well as those who are not. And once Rambam has created this kind of rational, functional framework, for Rambam, the question of Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reasons for the mitzvot, is a question of function. How do they serve to create the kind of community that is stable, moral, and creates an environment for individuals to achieve religious success? He then argues, again, following his rationalist bent, he argues that every single mitzvah, bar none, fits in some way or another to that goal. we had seen last week that that leads to a certain measure of tension, because it's very difficult to explain every single mitzvah down to the last one as having a function within the larger framework of Tikkun HaGuf and Tikkun HaNefesh. There are mitzvot for which it is fairly obvious. The prohibition of perjury in court is obviously necessary for the maintenance and the creation of a stable society and a stable body politic. But shatnez is more complicated. And korbanot for Rambam are more complicated. How exactly does a person achieve spiritual success? How does the community achieve spiritual success by killing animals and sprinkling their blood? How does the refusal to wear various kinds of garments made of particular materials, how does that contribute to the individual or the community's knowledge of God, knowledge of the truth? And here, Rambam is able to explain many mitzvot, and through the third section of the Moreh Nevuchim, he really systematically tries to go through all the mitzvot and explain every single one. But this leads him into two important caveats. One is that according to Rambam, what we mean by a rational, functional mitzvah, sometimes we have to explain in historical terms. In other words, since the goal is communal, it's not only communal in the here and now, in whatever location, in whatever time you happen to be living, it's communal in the sense that the larger goal is to bring Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, and the world as a whole along some path toward perfection. And that means gradually weaning the world away from a pagan, idolatrous worldview, which really dominated the ancient world, and to bring them toward an increasingly monotheistic worldview. And the mitzvot, some of them, can be explained in those historical terms. God had to give people the mitzvah of korbanot because in the ancient world they could not have appreciated the kinds of more ideal, silent, spiritual worship that is closer to the truth. And you have to gradually, over the course of history, wean the community away from idolatry. And so you're better off going in stages from idolatrous sacrifices to monotheistic sacrifices, and eventually toward prayer, and eventually even, Rambam hints, from prayer to silent worship, which, according to Rambam, at least in the Moreh Nevuchim, is a more ideal kind of worship. So his attempt to explain all of mitzvot rationally push him in a kind to kind of historicize things. Now, of course, this is a very dangerous idea. Rambam was criticized and attacked for it, because if a certain mitzvah is time-bound, is dependent on a certain condition in the pagan world. So, well, nowadays, we don't really need to wean ourselves off of the paganism of ancient idolatry, so, you know, why don't we do away with korbanot? And Rambam, of course, doesn't believe that you can do away with korbanot. He still thinks that korbanot are absolutely binding, but it's hard to explain why, given his historicization of mitzvot in the Moreh Nevuchim. The second issue, also controversial, that his attempt to explain all mitzvot rationally leads is Rambam's claim that the details, not only can we not explain certain details, but that certain details are inexplainable. They cannot be explained. There is no function of certain details. Law works that way. All law works that way. All law has a certain measure of arbitrariness. There must be a certain number of korbanot on a particular day, and what that number is does not mean anything. It just is, in the same way that there has to be a certain number of legislators in a particular parliament, and the number, as long as it's within the within reason, it doesn't matter whether there are 100 or 150 or 180. It's more or less an arbitrary number, and all law has to include a certain measure of arbitrariness. And this allows Rambam to try to deal with some of the details of the mitzvot in a, it allows certain not apparently rational aspects of the details of the mitzvot to explain them away as simply being details which cannot be explained by definition, arbitrary by definition. And that was the most, Rambam is the most consistent, detailed, systematic attempt to do a rational Ta'amei HaMitzvot, to explain each and every mitzvah Torah is fitting into the larger question of what the goal of Torah and mitzvot are as a whole. Now, that is kind of by way of brief summary of what we tried to cover last week, and that, I hope, will serve as a beginning for today's discussion. If there is some chance that the relevant sources have arrived by email, is there some chance that the relevant sources have arrived by email?
It is, but I can't open it and send it out. I'm working on it. But just,
okay.
You know, go ahead, and if I send it out, I'll let you know.
Okay, so what I want to work on today, and we'll see how much of it we can get through, and perhaps we'll continue with it next week, is to look at the opposite side of the coin, according to two thinkers, philosophers, also of the Middle Ages, who are responding to Rambam. In the case of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the author of Sefer HaKuzari, not responding directly to Rambam because chronologically he's two generations prior to Rambam, but responding certainly to the intellectual, rational atmosphere that eventually that the Rambam grew up in and really is the pinnacle of. A follower of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, somebody who was deeply influenced by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, is Maharal, both of whose theory of Ta'amei HaMitzvot is kind of grounded in attempt to reject Rambam's position and, more specifically, to question the attempt to explain mitzvah observance rationally. And it's not only a question of whether or not Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi or Maharal agree or disagree with this or that explanation. It's a much larger question. It's a question of whether or not we ought to be in the business of explaining mitzvot. And that, I think, underlines not only a question of the particular question of Ta'amei HaMitzvot, it gets at a core religious sensibility which is radically different. A kind of sensibility that I think can't be reduced to an answer to this or that question. It's a question, it's an issue of a different way of experiencing religion. It's a different way of experiencing Torah. It's a different way of thinking through, who people are relative to God. And I want to actually start, again, a little bit anachronistically with Tiferet Yisrael, which comes after Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi Sefer HaKuzari, but I want to read some sections from the sixth perek of Tiferet Yisrael, what appears to be a kind of rather childish attack on Maharal's part against the Rambam, and my claim is that it is not childish, that underneath it is lying a very deep and important question about the nature of religion and the nature of Torah. I will, in the absence of the sources having been sent out, I'm going to read them, I will translate them, I will read them slowly. If you have any questions, if I'm going too quickly, if something is not clear, if you have any questions on the previous discussion, please chime in, whether through the microphone or on the chat. Binyamin, you were trying to chime in.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
is Binyamin Weiss and Thornhill. I was just wondering if these two views are mutually exclusive, the Rambam's and, say, the views of the Maharal, can they not coexist?
I think in the particular ways they're expressed by Maharal and Rambam, they cannot coexist. In other words, I think Rambam and Maharal and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi are staking out mutually exclusive positions. They know that that's what they're doing. That's exactly what they want to be doing. And they're happy to, they'll agree to disagree. I think in the religious life of an individual, it's possible to try to find a balance. But in the way they're stated by Rambam and Tiferet Yisrael, I really think they are mutually exclusive. Let's take a look at Tiferet Yisrael, Perek Vav. If you have it, great. If not, I will try to read slowly. Okay, he begins, Tiferet Yisrael is Maharal's book about Torah, about the nature of Torah. Maharal, Rav Yehuda Loi of Prague, was a Rav of Prague in the 16th century. He wrote a series, a complete set of the writings of Maharal, runs some 20 volumes. commentaries on Agatha in the Gemara, commentaries, super commentary on Rashi, various monographs on topics, Perusha and the Haggadah, all kinds of things, in a particular kind of winding literary style that circles back on itself and goes, it's almost telegraphing all kinds of ideas. He's not so much making arguments as much as he is. He's kind of expressing a kind of mystical way of seeing the world. And I'm not sure that I understand him entirely, or rather I don't think there's anybody who really claims to understand everything of the Maharal, but there's a lot there, and you kind of have to stew in him for a long time to get a sense. In answer to Binyamin's question in the chat, if he influenced the Balatanya, the answer is yes. He was a tremendous influence on Chassidut as a whole, and on the Balatanya in particular. He kind of begun a path that the Balatanya really took to the end of kind of questioning the reality of the physical world and beginning to kind of see physicality as to some degree illusory, something that the Balatanya, to the extent that I understand it, really took much further. In Tiferet Yisrael, his book on the nature of Torah, Maharal says as follows in the sixth parak: Yesh mi bnei Adam, there are people, v'hem anshei chokrei lev ha'olchim b'darchei ha'filosofim, who are researchers who follow the paths of the philosophers, chokrim mi da'atam v'sichlam al kol advarim. They research with their minds all things. Tamua beinehem ma'od b'inyan ha'mitzvot p'ma'asiyot she'izkeh ha'adam atzlacha nitzchit ba'olam ha'nivdal al yedea mitzvah she'hi gashmit. They have a question, they have a problem with the mitzvot ha'ma'asiyot, with the practical mitzvot, the mitzvot that require action. How does a person acquire permanent, eternal success, eternal life in a separate, non-physical world, in Olam Haba, through the mitzvot, which are themselves physical? How is it that if the ultimate goal is Chaye Olam Haba, is a supernal world, a non-physical world, how is it that these various physical acts lead us toward non-physical success? V'yoter mizeh, he matmihin mi elu hayu mitzvot kulam hakavanot tchunot tovot v'nefesh ha'adam, כמו מצוות צדקה ומצוות לא תשנא אחיך בלבביך ולא תעמוד על דם רעך. They continue and say, it would be okay if all of the mitzvot were good qualities in the soul of a person. Like the mitzvah of tzedaka and the mitzvah of not hating your brother in your heart and not standing idly by your brother's blood, ukiyotzevahen, and similar mitzvot. In other words, I would be a little more comfortable, they would be, these philosophers would be a little more comfortable with the notion that mitzvot can achieve success, disembodied success in Olam Haba, disembodied perfection in Olam Haba, if what the mitzvot did was to develop our character in a moral direction. Maharal, I assume here, is hinting at the philosophical, the claim of the Aristotelians and the claim of Rambam in particular, that in order to achieve individual religious success, spiritual perfection, you have to be a moral person, and that's kind of a prerequisite. You can't focus on the eternal truths. You can't learn the truth of God. You can't meditate on the truth of God without first being a moral person who has some self-control, who is concerned about others. In other words, if all the mitzvot were teaching good moral qualities, then we'd be all right. Then I could say that through performing these mitzvot, the person acquires good character traits and distances himself from evil. The mitzvah of sha'atneiz, of not eating, of not wearing certain clothing made of wool and linen, and not planting different species of plants in the same field, ומצוות שחיטה מן הצוואר ולא מן העורף, and the mitzvah of shechita from the front of the neck and not from the back of the neck, ומקדש מליקה מן העורף ולא מן הצוואר, and in the temple, snipping off the head of the bird from the back of the neck and not from the front of the neck. What are we going to do with those mitzvot? And Maharal, I think, particularly picks the example of shechita because he says, here we have an example where the normal way to do shechita on most animals is from the front of the neck. You slit their windpipe at the front of the neck, and the food pipe at the front of the neck. Yet in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, when birds were sacrificed, they were slaughtered by the back of the neck. And that seems to be a contradiction to the claim that there could be a particular function, a particular moral meaning behind the notion of shechita. He's picked this particular example because the lack of consistency in the mitzvah itself is what demonstrates that there doesn't appear to be a particular rhyme or reason behind it. Now, Rambam might answer this question by saying, yeah, that's one of the details that is by definition arbitrary in any legal system. Maybe there's something there to differentiate the temple worship from the regular consumption of meat. But Maharal is not satisfied with that. And he continues. Vine. Right, Binyamin wants to know that the Yom Kippur service, the Azazel goat, what in particular about it? That it also seems to be irrational, although there seems to be a symbolism in the psukim itself that we put the sins of the people on the goat, whatever that means, and it's it being let out to die in the wilderness is somehow symbolic of our sins, whatever that means. I'm not sure that I understand what that means. I'm not sure that the rationalists have a good explanation other than the historical one that Rambam had suggested. But I'm not sure that I followed the question, Binyamin.
I just meant to say that I'm just backing up the morale in the sense that the whole Yom Kippur service seems to be cloaked in stuff that's not terribly rational,
yes,
and it's central.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's the pivotal service of the year.
Right, right. Exactly the kind of thing that forced Rambam into a corner to historicize Korbanot in particular. The idea that somehow I, as an individual, can get kapara by killing an animal seems bizarre to a rational mind at best. So this is one of the things that pushes Rambam particularly in a corner. So Maharal continues. Vine mem chatrud rachim harbe lafet siba v'tam kfi da'atam asher rachok midarkei Torah umidarkei hachamim. And therefore they hunted down various kinds of explanations that according to Maharal are distant from the Torah and distant from the words of the chachamim. V'yodei ha-Torah elehen bovad niglu matzpunei ha-chokhma v'ha-emet. And we have a rather cryptic sentence. The ones who know Torah, to them alone were revealed the secrets of wisdom and truth. Now, Maharal here is hinting at something that we're going to see. It may take us into next week, but we're going to see as being very critical. To the ones who know Torah, to them alone have been revealed the secrets of wisdom and truth. In other words, Maharal begins, first of all, this language is highly mysterious. In other words, whatever kind of explanation you're going to come up with to explain mitzvot, it is not going to be rational. It is going to be some element of mystery about it. It's matzpunei ha-chokhma v'ha-emet. It's the hidden parts of wisdom and truth. More than that, it is not something that anybody at all could get access to. Yodei ha-Torah bilvad elehem niglu. Only those who know Torah, and I don't think he means those who daf yomi, I think he means nothing against those yomi, but he means those who are chachmei nistar, as Binyamin says. Chachmei nistar, it's a little bit hard because Maharal's relationship to Kabbalah is a little difficult to define. It's pretty clear that he was deeply influenced by the Zohar and by a Kabbalistic worldview in general, but he very, very rarely uses the language of the Kabbalah. He does not particularly speak of Sefirot, and it's not clear whether Maharal was among those who thought the Kabbalah was kind of along with Rav Hirsch, although Rav Hirsch probably had a different perspective, but it would say that there's something to the Kabbalah, but it's been exaggerated by some of its followers, or whether he really is a Kabbalist and just prefers not to talk about it. He prefers to keep it secret. That's a little hard to figure out. But there's something hidden here, and it's nigle. It's something that is revealed. It's not something you can figure out using reason. It's something that, if you're lucky enough, it can be revealed to you as some kind of a secret. So it's not only that Maharal thinks that the rationalist explanation of mitzvot is inadequate, it's that he thinks it's methodologically flawed. You're barking up the wrong tree if you think you're going to figure it out. There's some other method, some hidden way of having it revealed to you that is not easy to figure out. Now let's get to the part that on the surface appears almost childish. And the truth is, it would be appropriate not to respond to their question at all. This thing that they want to give some necessary explanation for all things, if we had seen that they had given an explanation for all the natural, insignificant things, then it would be necessary for us to pay attention to their question. And even though the difference between natural wisdom, between science, the study of nature, and the study of Torah is as distant as the heaven is from the earth, because nature is in the world and Torah is in the heavens, ki me'olam ha'elyon, it comes from the upper world, then it would be necessary for us to pay attention to the question. The things are not that way. Natural things, such as plants and animals, they don't give us an explanation and a reason. How could you possibly explain every limb, every nuance of the biology, a loose translation here, the biology of every plant and animal? Pay little attention to the doctors and to the natural scientists, because at best they give explanation for one in a thousand. Okay. Maharal seems to be saying, if I understand him correctly, that the truth is that these rationalists are full of baloney, and we don't really have to pay any attention to them at all. How do I know that I don't even have to answer their question about mitzvot? I don't have to answer their question about mitzvot because they don't even do a good job of explaining nature. Now, this strikes me, frankly, as to a certain degree silly. So they haven't succeeded in explaining all of nature, and therefore we don't have to take seriously their question about ta'ameh mitzvot. I mean, they're asking a serious question. They're genuinely searching in Torah to try to explain what it means and what it's good for, and why we're doing all these rituals and all these practices and all these behaviors. So, all right, so they can't explain all of nature. They can't explain every limb and every plant and animal. So what? For this reason, we don't have to pay any attention to their question? So what's Maharal getting at? Any
yeah,
thoughts?
Just to jump in again, I'm just wondering historically, what was going on in the Maharal's time that might have compelled him to come up with a position like this?
Okay. So to the extent that I understand it, first of all, science was, we were talking about the late Middle Ages, the early Renaissance. The Renaissance in Italy was, alive and well, but it hadn't quite made it to this. Science was ill-developed. Certainly the kind of experimental science that we know from modernity was ill-developed, although some of Maharal's students were actually... Gantz, I'm forgetting his first name, Rav Gantz, one of Maharal's students, was also a student of Tycho Brahe, the student of Copernicus. In other words, science was beginning to wake itself up, but there wasn't yet a sense that science had kind of conquered the kind of modernistic confidence in science that developed in the 18th and 19th century certainly was not dominant. Would not have been a serious enough issue for Maharal. Seriously, science was genuinely limited. Why is Maharal, you know, throwing out the question? Why does he refuse to take the question seriously? Thoughts?
I was just thinking that this might have been threatening in some way, and also I keep associating him. I keep associating him with wasn't he the one who built the golem? Or I don't know if that's just myth or story, but he seems to be associated with the Kabbalistic side of things. Quite frankly, in much the same way as I believe the Rambam's son is. I think his name was. Was it Avram or David? I'm not sure, but I'm thinking that, you know, this is a very strong sort of motif that's hard to ignore, and it's so polar opposite to the rational perspective of things.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of things that are worth paying attention to. Judy has added, consider mitzvot rationales based on faulty knowledge of science lead people to rejecting the mitzvot when the principles are refuted. But we've got a couple of ideas here that have been floated around in these answers. One is a sense that Maharal is threatened, and that's certainly not out of the question. There's a sense to which kind of growing rationalism, even if imperfect at the moment, is somehow a kind of a deep threat to a kind of mystical worldview that Maharal adopts. Binyamin is correct that Maharal is associated with the golem, although not at the time when he was writing. The association of the Maharal with the golem didn't develop until the beginning of the 19th century modern invention. There is no actual evidence whatsoever. Had anything whatsoever to do with a golem, but certainly a kind of mystical worldview. And Judy correctly points out that there's a deep concern that an attempt to rationalize mitzvot, particularly based on faulty or not adequately developed science, is going to lead people to reject the mitzvot when the principles are refuted. If science is only speculation. And we're going to base our explanations of mitzvot on speculation. So then, where are we? What are we going to do when speculation is refuted? I think those are certainly, undoubtedly, relevant issues. And I want to take it actually half a step further. Binyamin mentioned that there's kind of two mutually exclusive worldviews that are going out at here. And I'd like to suggest that the reason why Maharal says we don't have to answer their question because they can't explain nature is really getting the core idea that it's really getting at is that the world is not a rational place. In other words, if the world was a rational place, if reason had succeeded in explaining everything else about the universe, then I might be convinced that the world is fundamentally a rational place. If the world is a rational place, a commitment to explaining mitzvot rationally. But until reason succeeds in explaining the world adequately, what confidence do I have is something different entirely? Maybe what's really motivating, what's really at work in the world the way we see it, is not reason. It's not something we can get at using our minds. It's something we can get at, if at all, using very different tools. At the core, mahalukah, the core dispute between Rambam and Maharal, and we'll see in a minute, I think, Rav Yehuda Halevi as well, to a lesser degree, is not only the question of whether we ought to use reason to explain Torah, but whether reason as a tool is adequate to explain anything. Binyamin mentions reason can't explain the concept of soul. I don't follow this stuff in great detail, but the question is still alive and well. If we're going to translate this, let me take another half a step back, right, to try to translate this into modern terms, right? Somebody could claim, I think, with a certain degree of truth, somebody could come along and say, listen, that would maybe have been true in Prague in the 16th century, but we're now in the 21st century, and frankly, science has taken giant steps forward in explaining nature, and the sense that we can just kind of undermine a rationalist worldview by saying, well, the world is not a rational place. The world certainly seems to be a pretty rational place. Reason and science have done a fairly good job of explaining all kinds of things that until recently were totally mysterious. And maybe Maharal's attack on science and reason as a whole is premature. And Binyamin's suggestion, I don't follow this in great detail, but in religious groups, Jewish and otherwise, there still is a dispute between reductionist science and at least certain strains of religion that don't buy it. Binyamin mentions the concept of a soul. To the extent that I understand it, the debate is kind of revolving around consciousness today, in which reductionist scientists will tell you all human emotion, all human experience can ultimately be reduced to kind of neurotransmitters, what's happening in the brain. It's all about kind of brainwaves, and it can all really be reduced to biology. Religious people, or people who are not convinced by that claim on other grounds, look and say, listen, how does that explain consciousness? That might explain that there is apparently some biological, element to sadness or happiness or euphoria or depression or whatever. How does that explain that there's that there's an ego that's aware of being sad, or that's aware of being depressed, or aware of being ecstatic? Yisrael says, the more one learns, the more he sees that he does not know. In other words, the smarter I get, the dumber I get. So I wouldn't say that science explains a good part of the world and raises as many questions as it has answered, right? The more we know, the more we discover that we haven't explained things, that there are lots of things that are left unexplained. I saw an op-ed piece, I think, in one of the newspapers by Steven Pinker, the Harvard neurobiologist, who has pretty systematically tried to explain everything from kind of language to emotion on totally biological terms. It's one of the leading spokespeople today, public spokespeople for kind of reductionist science, that it all boils down to physics and chemistry. Addressing exactly the question of the soul, exactly the question of consciousness. And his argument was basically, systematically, science has explained more and more and more. And neurosciences are, and this is almost exactly the language he used, neuroscience is confident that real soon we'll be able to explain consciousness also. He might be right, maybe that'll happen scientifically. But the fact that neuroscientists are confident that they'll do it is not the same as saying that they've done it yet. Heschel has has a variation on the theme when he says the more we understand about the workings of science, the less we understand the nature of being at all. The more micro explanations we have for the chemistry and biology of life, the bigger the macro questions of where it all came from and why there's anything and not nothing become. So as much as kind of modern science has maybe would maybe phrase the Maharal's question differently, I think the Maharal's question continues to stand and continues to be debated today between kind of rationalists and non-rationalists or anti-rationalists. And Maharal's fundamental point is it's that the world is just not a rational place. And the attempt to do an explanation of mitzvot on purely rational terms is doomed to failure in the same way that an attempt to figure out everything about the cosmos in purely rational terms is doomed to failure. Now, if we look at the Maharal carefully, however, the one sentence that we spent a little time on before in terms of in terms of the people to whom this is revealed, the Yodei Torah, to whom the truth is revealed, the implication of Maharal is that claiming that mitzvot are not necessarily rational is not the same as saying that they are entirely arbitrary. And what Rav Yehuda HaLevi intends to do is to try to explain mitzvot in such a way that they could be both, on the one hand, not rational, but not arbitrary. There can be explanation, there can be some kind of meaning behind the apparent madness, but that meaning may not be meaning that can be explained using the tools of reason. And the search that Maharal and Tiferet Yisrael are after is a search for explanation in a language that is other than rational. Now, this kind of leads them into a bit of a problem, Maharal more than Rav Yehuda HaLevi. Rav Yehuda HaLevi's language is a little more accessible and kind of down to earth than that of Maharal. But what's that language going to look like? What kind of terms do we use to try to get explanation, but explanation that is irrational? Not irrational, just not rational. So what language do we have to explain things, the meaning of mitzvot, in terms that are other than rational, other than functional, other than I can explain every mitzvah and how it fits into the larger picture? So I want to skip now for a second to a passage in Sefer HaKuzari. Now, Sefer HaKuzari is a little bit difficult to kind of pin down for reasons that, now is not the time to get into. But Sefer HaKuzari is an absolute masterpiece. I say that only because it's a book that the more you read, the more you discover is there, the more surprises it holds for you. The second you think you understand something in Sefer HaKuzari, something that surprises you and takes it a step further. And Rav Yehuda HaLevi, Sefer HaKuzari was written in the 12th century by Rav Yehuda HaLevi, one of the leading poets and religious leaders of Spanish Jewish community. As the Christian reconquest of Spain was going on, eventually, toward the end of his life, headed toward Eretz Israel. And Sefer HaKuzari is his kind of philosophical book, and it's written as a kind of intellectual, spiritual, philosophical dialogue between a fictional king of the Khazars, who, according to the legend, had converted to Judaism, and the Chaver, the rabbi, the Jewish scholar, who tries to convince him or is trying to have a conversation with him about the meaning of life, about Torah, about mitzvot, etc. And it's hard to pin down Sefer HaKuzari because it's this kind of conversation, and conversation never quite fits into our preconceived patterns of where it's supposed to go. It starts somewhere, and before you know it, you're talking about something totally different. And Rav Yehuda HaLevi, the poet, and not only the philosopher, was trying to capture some of that kind of aural nature of the conversation, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, if you will. And you kind of never know around which turn and the topic that you thought you had already covered 50 pages ago is going to reappear. So every time you think you understand what's happening in Sefer HaKuzari, there's, you know, another passage later on. But I want to read a couple of passages and see if we can see how he's dealing with the issue of had this been possible, philosophers with their wisdom and acumen would have achieved even more than Israel. Losing sound. How many of you are losing sound? Tech support, you want to fill us in? I still hear. If you don't hear me well, please say something. Does anybody hear me? Hold on 1 second.
Better. I hear you fine.
Okay, good. So, in the service of God, there is no arguing, reasoning, and debating. Had this been possible, philosophers with their wisdom and acumen would have achieved even more than Israel. Okay, the first sentence is fairly clear, right? When it comes to doing mitzvot, you can't reason about it, you can't debate about it, you can't argue about it, which means, I think, something at two levels. First of all, God says do it, you do it. And at a second level, it means that the attempt to find a reason is probably limited, and that gets into the second sentence. Had this been possible, philosophers with their wisdom and acumen would have achieved even more than Israel. What do you think Rav Yehuda Halevi means by that last sentence? Anybody have ideas about what Rav Yehuda Halevi might mean by that last sentence? The Torah would be unnecessary, right? The Torah would be unnecessary at two levels. It would be unnecessary at one level, namely the level of you could figure it out on your own. If Torah was really rational, if Torah was really just what reason would eventually tell us to do, then you could figure it out on your own. We would see, and Rav Yehuda Halevi says this in many times, all over the place. He says, look at the philosophers. How many of them have achieved prophecy? How many of them have achieved spiritual perfection? That's the real test, right? The real test is in results. Not in whether it looks good on paper, not whether the argument seems to be compelling when you hear it. The real question is the results. And the philosophers don't achieve prophecy, which Rav Yehuda Halevi assumes or argues is the pinnacle of human spiritual perfection. If it was rational, you could figure it out. And if you could figure it out, those who didn't have revelation, those who did not have hidgalut, those who did not have Torah and mitzvot, would be able to achieve spiritual perfection. And he says, as a matter of fact, they don't. Right? And look also in Chelek Bet, in the second section of Sefer HaKuzari, paragraph 32, the Chaver says, the dead nations which desire to be held equal to the living, in other words, meaning the Gentile nations, which claim to be equal, can obtain nothing more than an external resemblance. They can only look like us from the outside. They build houses for God, but no trace of him was visible therein. They turned hermits and ascetics in order to secure inspiration, but it came not. They then deteriorated, became disobedient and wicked, yet no fire fell down from heaven upon them, nor rapid pestilence as a manifest punishment from God for their disobedience. In other words, here, Rav Yehuda Halevi is dealing with, would it be helpful if I read that again? Did I clear the first time? If you want me to read it again, let me know. What Rav Yehuda Halevi is dealing with here is the external similarity between Judaism's mitzvot and other mitzvot, and the commandments, the ritual practice, the religious behavior of other religions. If it's really true that Torah and mitzvot are above and beyond what humans can figure out on their own, as Maharal had told us and had reviewed Halevi had indicated, then why the external similarity between our mitzvot and theirs? They bring korbanot, we bring korbanot. They say tefillot and prayer, we say tefillot and prayer. The season rolls around, right? We have a late winter festival in which we light candles. They have a late winter festival in which they light candles. But there appears to be some similarity, some point of comparison. You can do comparative religion and give an accounting of Torah and mitzvot using those terms. So if that's true, if it's really true that that mitzvot are irrational, that they're above and beyond human comprehension, and certainly above and beyond human creation, then why the similarity? And Rav Yehuda Halevi's answer that he's hinting at in that paragraph is that the similarity is an external resemblance. They built houses for God, but no trace of him was visible therein. They turned hermits and ascetics in order to secure inspiration, but it came not. They became disobedient and wicked, and they did not get punished. In other words, how do you know? It is true that there is some external semblance of similarity between Torah and Mitzvot and other religions, but it's illusory. How do you know that it's illusory? Because it doesn't work. Now, Rav Yehuda Halevi is convinced that he can demonstrate that Jews have achieved nevuah and prophecy and Gentiles have not. He's convinced that historically he can demonstrate that Jewish history follows a pattern of reward and punishment and Gentile history does not. And that's the key to the argument, right? It's not rational. There's something else at work. Even if it appears to be similar, the appearance is on the surface. And how do you know? Because getting closeness to God involves following the rules that God gives you, and following those rules work because of some kind of divine system, and you don't have access to it. And that is why and that is why you need Torah. You need Torah because the way to get close to God is determined by what God wants, and you can't get access to what God wants on your own. Binyamin mentions Amsgula concept is not rational either, which is correct, and this is tied into Rav Yehuda Halevi's argument, right? Only we can achieve Nevuah, because only we are the Amsgula who has this special relationship with Hashem, and therefore only we can achieve Nevuah and get close to God. And so this is kind of tied together in Rav Yehuda Halevi's perspective. The idea that mitzvot should not be explained exclusively in rational terms is tied up with the idea that we succeed where they fail. Yes, in answer to Binyamin's question, Rambam does differ. He thinks the notion of Am Segula can be reduced to the question of who, in historical terms, happened to have gotten the Torah. But in theory, Gentiles can achieve religious perfection. In fact, some Gentiles probably achieve more religious perfection than Jews, and he certainly rejects Rav Yehuda Halevi's notion that only Jews, kind of biologically or genetically, can achieve nevuah. Okay, we're running out of time, and I want to kind of close up here, which does not mean that we're finished with the discussion, because both Rav Yehuda Halevi and Maharal still owe us an explanation, if not a rational one, of how is it that this system of Torah and Mitzvot succeeds in achieving religious perfection if you can't be explained rationally. Again, the problem we hinted at before. Yes, there is some kind of explanation. Somehow doing these various activities brings individuals and nations closer to God, but you owe me an explanation of how that works. And both Maharal and Rav Yehuda Halevi has hinted that it's not arbitrary. There is something in these behaviors that achieves religious perfection. He just hasn't told us what it is, and he's confined us. They've confined us to explanations that are irrational, and it isn't even clear what kind of an explanation that could be and what it would look like. So that remains, and that we're gonna. Looks like we're gonna have to pay attention to next week. Will be a further discussion of some of the explanations that Sefer HaKuzari and Maharal do give. What I do want to end with, though, is kind of by way of response to Binyamin's last question. Yes, Rambam differs. It's not a question, merely a question of Ta'amei HaMitzvot. Ta'amei HaMitzvot becomes a lens through which to kind of get at totally different religious sensibilities, which Rav Yehuda Halevi and Maharal's religious sensibility is something, their whole notion of what it means to be a religious person is one that is beyond what I can understand. It is the element of submission to something that is beyond, transcendent, well beyond anything I can explain, in which my mind is not the criteria that determines what's good and bad, and I sacrifice myself and my own criteria to what I have been given by revelation, is a very different sensibility to Rambam, who begins almost methodologically with reason and with the assumption that reason is valid and Torah must be explained in rational terms. And if it can't be, well, then you've got a serious problem, but whatever explanation you're going to come up with is going to have to be true both to reason and to Torah. And it seems to me that that gets at kind of very different notions of what it means to be a religious person, very different experiences of what it means to be a religious person, and for people who are actually paying attention to what they're doing, and that is, as life becomes increasingly complicated, at least for me, increasingly difficult to do. But if we're really paying attention to what we're doing, what do we experience when we pay attention to what we're doing? When we, you know, don't, when we, you know, wear certain items of clothing, when we don't take medicines on Shabbat, when we don't, pick out the forks and knives from the pile differently on Shabbat than on other days. Well, what does it mean to us when we do that? How do we explain to ourselves what it is that we're doing? And the machloket between Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi really, I think, really kind of encapsulates two models of how to think about it. Okay, that is, I think, where we're going to leave off for today. Any last final questions, pipe in. If not, God willing, I will hear or see or chat many of you next week. Yisrael, your question didn't come through.
Is there a possibility, perhaps, that we're taking a Rambam a little too literally, that he would never say that he's not trying to portray the whole thing as being rational? Who could possibly think that? Just that there's a benefit to each mitzvah, and there's rationality you can find in each mitzvah, and if you want to be creative enough, you probably can do that. Rav Hirsch does it plenty. But he doesn't mean to say everything's rational.
I think the answer to Yisrael's question is that I don't think we need to soften Rambam. I don't think he's trying to kind of give you an apologetic strategy. Because it's consistent with Rambam's larger worldview, in which the Torah's image of God has to be consistent with a rational image of God, and the notion of nevuah has to be consistent with a kind of rational psychology, and in which if there is an, when push really comes to shove, Rambam is prepared to accept elements of Torah, for example, Tchiyat Meitim, for which he has no rational explanation. At least the exoteric Rambam, the explicit Rambam, certainly would say that if push comes to shove, there may be things in Torah that we have to accept despite the fact that we can't explain them. But Rambam is so consistent in his attempt to give an explanation for Judaism as a whole in rational terms that I wouldn't soften his language about Ta'amei HaMitzvot. That's my reading of it.
I would respond by saying two things to that. One is, we're not calling God irrational just because he doesn't tell us all his reasons. He could be rational and just be hiding things. And the second thing is, I know Rav Soloveitchik often talks about how there's a rationality to irrationality, that just the idea of us following commands, even when they're not explained to us, has a benefit on us that you can explain rationally.
Right. So the notion of kind of rationality of irrationality, the last point that you made, is kind of, it's picked up in Rav Sajigon in Sefer Emunot V'Deot in the section on Ta'amei HaMitzvot, which I thought about starting with today, but seeing that the group was very different from last week, we didn't go into it. There he talks about, he distinguishes a famous distinction in Ta'amei HaMitzvot between mitzvot sichliot and mitzvot shimiot, rational mitzvot, by which he means mitzvot that we would come up with on our own, even if they were never given, and mitzvot shimiot, by which he means mitzvot that we would not come up with on our own if they weren't given, but once they are given, then we discover that they're actually good for various things. And that seems to tie in a little bit to the distinction you're making in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, or the category of the rational and the irrational, the rationality of the irrational. But for Rambam, it's not, to say that, that God has his reasons, but he's hiding them, for the Rambam is not enough. Because Rambam's image of God is God doesn't have, if you'll pardon the expression, and this is a kind of a little jarring language, but I think this is really what Rambam's getting at. Rambam's God doesn't have enough personality to do that. Rambam's God is also confined by reason. Rambam's God does what reason compels a God to do. And Rambam doesn't quite go as far as some of the other medieval rationalists to say, and what ultimately led Spinoza to say, that therefore the world is totally predetermined. Since God is rational, and rational could only be one way and not another way, therefore the world could only be one way and not any other way. Rambam doesn't go quite that far, but Rambam's God is so rational that he doesn't even have that kind of personality that he could say, well, there's reason behind it, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. Rambam's God is the kind of God who does what reason demands, and therefore the kind of Torah that God could give is only a kind of rational Torah. And more than that, the connection between humankind and God is through reason for Rambam. So reason.
This is Benjamin again. Yeah. You mentioned interestingly enough exoteric Rambam. Was there in fact an esoteric Rambam?
Well, this is first of all, we're running over time. I suppose it's not a regular class, so I can't. Anybody who wants to leave at this point can, which I sometimes tell my own students in a physical classroom. And here, I suppose, if you want to leave, you can just log off. But the question of whether or not there's an esoteric layer in Rambam is subject to a great deal of debate. The introduction to the Mor Nevuchim makes it very clear, contradictions in the Mor Nevuchim. The reason why there are contradictions in the Mor Nevuchim is because there are truths that I do not want a casual reader to understand. There are truths that the casual reader cannot handle. And the true reader, the serious reader of the Mor Nevuchim, will read it over and over again, connect the various places where a single topic is discussed, and figure out the inner meaning. And Rambam is using a kind of... Then the question becomes, what is Rambam? I mean, that's just a horrible introduction to a book, right? You open up a book, and on page one he tells you, this book is full of contradictions so that you won't understand me. Kind of makes the job of the reader terribly difficult. Disputes have gone on since then about what exactly it is that Rambam is hiding. From the most extreme voices, who think that Rambam really has some his esoteric view is extreme, and challenges various ideas that people assume are kind of orthodox or binding, to people who say that if you compare several passages in Rambam and you find a way of merging them together, you get a richer understanding of what Rambam was about. I don't claim to understand Rambam well enough to have an opinion about that, in that larger dispute. But it's certainly possible that there's a esoteric layer of Rambam, even if there's a great deal of dispute about how deep it is. If Rambam wanted to explain things to people, he did not succeed in explaining things to people to the extent that the debate began while Rambam was still alive and hasn't ended today. You're quite welcome. Great. I'm looking forward to next class as well, and it's been a great pleasure. And have a Shavua Tov.